becomes religion.
Yeah, Lost episode two, we talked about. But Charles, I do know you have a hard cutoff, so.
Yeah, well, like one, you know, I mean, in like an hour.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is salon number 10, the 10th salon, with Charles Hugh Smith, Jesse Hirsch, and myself, Mark E. Jeftovic. And I'm going to put all this stuff away now. How are you guys?
The E stands for easy, right?
That's right. Easy is my middle name.
Well, I'm
How
interested
are you, Mark?
In...
What?
I said, how are you, Mark?
I've been tense all week. I was telling you that on Signal the other day. I just feel like, I don't know. It feels like things are hitting some kind of, something's got to give. I don't know. It's really just stressful, I find. My personal situation is not stressful, but the world just feels like it's building towards some kind of crescendo, I think, and it's driving me a little. I think I pick up on that tension, and it drives me a little bonkers.
Well, whoever had June in the second wave pandemic pool, you know, come collect your prize, because it looks like that's what's going on, at least continentally speaking. There are lots of places in North America that are not seeing an uptake in infection or positive tests. But as a continent, I think our hopes of containing this have gone right out the window. And those who were cautiously optimistic or naively delusional are starting to understand the real power of this virus and the extent to which that it can and will disrupt society.
Yeah, I'm going to stand in line to collect that prize because, you know, I put on my blog post today, or you know, last night, this chart that I, you know, drew up on February 2nd, which I think is still playing out rather nicely. It kind of called out, there's going to, you know, they're going to open up the thing, the cities, and say everything's going well, and we're going to get a vaccine soon, and all this kind of, you know, euphoric stuff. And then reality's going to hit, and the next stage in my little exponential chart is, of course, the world wakes up to the fact that this is uncontrollable and the world, the global economy is in a depression. And so my first thoughts are, you know, the status quo has no plan B, right? In other words, all we can do is print money, shove it out to people, kind of cover, fill some potholes, and then hope it all kind of like magically, you know, resource itself into the extremes that were seemed to be clinging on, you know, 3 months ago. So they don't really have a plan B, and that, I think that's part of the schizophrenia that we're seeing, because they have to sell a euphoric positive narrative because they don't really have any other option. They you know, those of us who are willing to embrace degrowth are on the margins, on the extreme margins, you know, living in the Ottawa Valley, and and our mental mindscapes, we're definitely on the margins. So I think that's one of the drivers.
So the thing in the email I sent out this morning, that I was, when we were lining up today's call, I said, you know, what do you do when maximum pessimism and irrational exuberance are coexisting at the same time? Because that's the cognitive dissonance that I'm experiencing right now. And it's not that I was pessimistic or wanted to be pessimistic, or sorry, the other way around. It's not that I was optimistic or wanted to be optimistic. I just can't understand how stonks are going to all-time highs and, you know, all that really matters is this kind of irrational exuberance of you know, I saw some numbers print just before we got on this that, you know, the unemployment rate was only 14 million or something like that. I just thought, like, this is not good news. And yet, you know, the stock market's on fire and the streets are on fire simultaneously at the same time. And it just, I really, part of me is I subscribe to the old John Templeton maxim of, you know, when everyone is pessimistic, it's time to be optimistic. It's to be the contrarian. And at the same time, anyone who tried to be a contrarian through the last 10 years of irrational exuberance got their head handed to them. I don't mean just in terms of trading the markets or financially. It just feels like all the signaling really is broken, and I've hit this exhaustion point where I don't know what to make of it anymore. And, you know, maybe I am looking at it too myopically, too self-centeredly, but like over the last week I was just thinking, should I just pull in, circle the wagons, and just worry about making sure Easy DNS is okay, making sure my family's okay, and just stop shouting at clouds and stop doing all the political philosophy, because it's futility. And so that's kind of where I've hit this sort of a wall in the last week. And yet, I don't know. And yet I get a lot of people emailing me, and I'm seeing a lot of good input on all three of what we're putting out in writing. So it feels like, against the backdrop of all that, we actually seem to be catching a little bit of traction in that people are looking for something that's not CNN, not Fox News, not Breitbart or Vox, just somebody, people who are looking at this and just trying to parse through the data and make the best they can of it.
You know, previously we've evoked Isaac Asimov's Foundation.
Yes.
And sort of the moral or intellectual responsibility of thinking about knowledge in the midst of a civilization's collapse, or alternatively, thinking about knowledge in the building of a new civilization, which may take hundreds of years or thousands of years. And I think that's where our work has relevance in spite of the momentum that this collapse has. That there feels like there's nothing we can do to prevent the collapse, but still much that we can do to mitigate the worst effects of that collapse, to accelerate the alternative rising from ashes, or rising from within, depending on how slow that collapse may be. I mean, one of the themes that I think all three of us are interested in is the corruption of elites, the incompetence of elites, and the extent to which many civilizations are built a self-serving elite which uses the apparatus of power, the apparatus of the economy, to enrich themselves, that they're displaced presently. They're not in control, and that's part of why things are falling apart. And I think that creates an opportunity for a different narrative, a different approach. But your comments, Mark, also remind me that it's not just intellectual, that there's an emotional side to this that I think is just as important, if not more so, than the intellectual. Not just because people are afraid, but emotions tend to be, as people's, our prime response, tend to kick in afterwards. Our brain follow our reaction. And I think that also reinforces the value of work. For all emotional things, it's important that put in the effort to understand those emotions and understand our society and understand why we're yelling at clouds and why we're so pissed off. And to me, that's how I explain the irrational exuberance that we saw over the last 2 months. When the writing was on the wall, the place is on fire, get out, run for your lives. And everyone's like, no, man, the party's going on, the roof's on fire, let's not put it out. And so I think finally that narrative is no longer feasible. That the infection rates, not just across the United States, across Brazil, across Russia, you know, even China is now dealing with its own second wave that in many places is out of control. you know, narrative of this is not a big deal, that narrative is done, right? And now we're getting it back into the narrative of panic. There's those of us who've been like, yo, we've been saying this for months, and we think we have the roadmap. It's a decentralized society, and it's, you know, based on cooperation and based on decentralization. But then there are the others who go, no, the status quo is good. Don't worry, we'll print the money and the economy will come back. I think that narrative too is gonna fail. So I think it's important that in pursuing the intellectual, in pursuing the rational and the logical, we acknowledge the presence of emotion and the role of emotion. Because I think we are gonna see panic in the next week, in particular when it comes to the economy, as more people start to come to the position that Charles has had for quite some time, which is we're looking at a pretty big depression and not a short one.
Let me, Charles, can I just hold that thought? Your sound is really bad today, so I'm wondering if I should take a second to bounce off the VPN here to try and improve my signal so that you're less choppy. And the other thing I will mention, actually, I'm not going to mention that. I'm going to just do that, so everybody sit tight, and then I will let Charles talk. Hang on. And we're all back.
What's that?
We're all back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We never left, but you're back.
You guys flipped around on me. Anyhow, Charles, go.
Okay. Yeah, it's like, I think Jesse's raised a really interesting point that's often not been addressed, at least in the corporate media, which is the emotional impact of all this, right? We see anecdotal evidence of mental health hotlines increasing, suicides higher, a lot of tragic results of the emotional burdens this is creating. Even for myself, which I feel like, you know, I'm one of the protected few, I guess, in the sense that I'm not in danger of losing my job and all that stuff. You know, I find the whole thing exhausting. You know, I'm just like bloody tired, you know, mentally tired, emotionally tired, and even physically tired to some degree by this, the burdens of like trying to navigate this. But, you know, I've written just like the last couple pieces, which everybody's been able to see on Axis of Easy, about the idea that the elites have lost control. And that would of course, if we put ourselves in their shoes, what's their response going to be? To surrender? Well, of course not. They're going to, again, double, triple down, you know, like, in other words, increase the euphoria, jack the stock market up, you know, do everything within whatever's left in their power to evince the illusion they're still in control of the social order and the economic order. And I would submit they're no longer really in control of those. And then the other thing is just to remind, you know, the audience that what, you know, Jesse and Mark and I have often written about and talked about is the extremes that were just considered normal, you know, the old normal of that ended in 2020. It was just a bunch of extremes, you know, it was extreme monetary policy, extreme inequality, extreme corruption. I mean, extreme squandering of the Earth's resources. I mean, it was just nothing but one extreme piled on top of another. And so it was inevitable that there was going to be a collapse of that kind of extreme system. So whatever the cause, now it's the lockdown. If we hadn't had the lockdown, and nothing would have happened. And it's like, no, then some other puff of air would have blown the whole thing over. And now the dominoes are falling, which is the piece that's my current piece. And I think that's also, emotionally devastating, is to look at the dominoes and know that there's no way to stop them. You know, it's like we're observers and the dominoes are falling. And so where does it end? And that's where we're talking about, we got to give people hope for something better. And so we have to talk about degrowth. Like, well, hey, look at that system was insane, right? The one that's collapsing, that the dominoes are falling. So it's like good riddance, as painful as it will be, you know, and there's a much better future ahead, and we're going to sketch it out for you.
I, just before we started today, I finished a blog post, which I haven't published yet, on Out of the Cave, called You Want to Talk Privilege? Okay, let's talk privilege. And it's about the privilege that we all I mean, more so in the U.S., but Canada has been pretty much a beneficiary of the Bretton Woods U.S. dollar as global reserve currency system for, you know, the entire Bretton Woods era. And if you want to talk about systemic privilege and structural inequality, there is nothing more structurally baked into the cake than the ability to print value out of thin air and have every other nation on the face of the earth use it to backstop their currency. And that has led to this artificial inflation of living standards since the post-World War II era that's centered around Pax Americana and the US dollar reserve system. And what I thought was that there's this privilege perimeter that used to be outside of the continental United States and probably outside of Canada until around maybe the time Nixon took the US dollar off the gold exchange, the gold convertible, and then that perimeter started to constrict and people started to notice that the inequality that used to be externalized overseas now came home. And that Cantillon effect I rant about a lot, where the people closest to the Fed, to the central bank, to the money spigot benefit the most. And where it used to be the entire country would benefit and all of the unhappy externalities were overseas, now it's coming home to roost. And now that perimeter is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And what feels like, you know, structural inequality is that perimeter shrinking inside the continental United States. And so the middle class is finding themselves for the first time outside of that perimeter. And it's manifesting in all of this strife and civil unrest and all of that, because, you know, this was all supposed to change after 2008. It was supposed to be, you know, we're going to do a whole new reset. And it was just a continuation of the same system that just accelerated this kind of inequality until we got to the point that we are here. And to Charles's point, then the coronavirus just came along and took the wind right out of the sails.
See, it's funny, both of you guys describe a period of history which, you know, my subjective experience was both immediate and frustrating. And I'll respond, albeit abstract, with an anecdote. I remember in the late, when I was a university student, I participated loosely in an occupation of one of the banks in downtown Toronto at King and Bay. So these are, you know, huge skyscrapers, which are the headquarters of the Canadian financial system, the Canadian banks, and they're all located at this one intersection. And I can't remember which bank, I want to say it was RBC, Royal Bank of Canada, or it could have been Bank of Montreal, where, you know, we occupied the foyer. And all it was, I was kind of just hanging out. I was there sort of as a guy, so I was not an organizer, didn't totally understand the logic. And I think it was relatively spontaneous, but it was just one of those situations where there was a march, and the march led to the financial district because we were protesting the banks and capitalism. And then it went into the foyer of this bank, and everyone's occupying, like, we're not going to leave. And no one wanted to come out, because symbolically to me, it was sort of recognition that the power isn't here anymore. Like, this may be the physical headquarters of the bank, but there's no vault. There's no people, right? There's no actual money or value in the building. So the bank didn't really care that we were there. And there was this surreal point about 8 hours, 10 hours into the occupation, where the bank issued a press release saying, we support the protesters protesting against the government. And the government issued a press release saying, we support the protesters in their protest against the banks. And it very surreal, symbolic moment of reality, of the idea that the bank itself was the center of power. The occupation of the bank was totally meaningless, and the powers that be were in no way threatened. and we're perfectly fine for this little spectacle to happen. And of course, eventually people got tired and they went home because they realized that there wasn't much being accomplished by this particular occupation. So on the one hand, I think it speaks to the abstraction, the financialization of our system that is not only enabled by digital technology and globalization, but just divorces the material reality that people are used to from the power of money as a virtual concept that can be created without controls and without limits. But it also struck me as a kind of awareness amongst the people that they had little avenues for change. That if they didn't like things, they used to think that they could march in the streets. They used to think that they could occupy the halls of power. But it turns out you can't. That doesn't accomplish much. And I use this as a personal anecdote to also kind of suggest that Occupy Wall Street, which was a huge social movement, not just in New York, but around the world, and really articulated the concept of the 1% and the idea that a tiny elite control the economy, you know, they were largely ineffective. I mean, effective at raising awareness, effective at getting people to understand what was going on, but did they stop the 1%? No! Did they stop the power of Wall Street? No, not at all. That the physical occupation of Wall Street did not in any way impact the way in which Wall Street works. So I think to go back to this idea of we're observing the dominoes falling and there's not much we can do, I think agency is part of the problem. That people don't know how they can be effective. They don't know how they can be active participants in their democratic society. And that from a depressing perspective, is part of why I feel we're already in the authoritarian regime. We're already in the authoritarian era. We're the frogs who've been boiled so slowly that we're only now going, shit, the water's hot and it's boiling. Maybe we should jump out. And most people are like, I don't know, it feels like a good hot tub to me.
Mark, go ahead.
I was gonna say the most radical thing that actually accomplished something was Bitcoin and the whole cryptocurrency blockchain decentralization revolution, really. And I think it's still in the early innings to see how it's going to play out, but it was the first thing that actually fired a shot across the bow of these institutional.
See, I would, without getting too deep into it, I would put Bitcoin on the same level as Occupy Wall Street, with the exception being that Bitcoin is still in the game, to use your metaphor.
Well, it created.
So it still has a chance, but I would argue that what Bitcoin has accomplished is awareness, which is what Occupy Wall Street accomplished. Occupy Wall Street did not accomplish structural change, nor has Bitcoin yet.
But I don't know about that.
That they're still in the game.
Because Bitcoin has created a new asset class. And I think that's the underappreciated thing about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies themselves, is that there has been no real change in the former structure of money in hundreds of years until Bitcoin came along. And it actually created a new financial asset that was not built on debt and had no counterparty. And that was that's what took the creation of value away from the central bankers. And that is such a huge deal, because whoever controls the monetary system controls society, and that fact, that central fact, is lost on the majority of people. And the authors that I always come back to who documented this the most were Stephen Zarlinga, who wrote the book.
So you've made this point successfully with us. Just suggesting that the people who control Bitcoin are not the people I want controlling society. So that's why I'm suggesting that there's still work needs to be done for me to feel that we're headed in the right direction rather than heading into something worse.
Oh, no doubt.
Let's throw to Charles.
Well, let me backtrack a little bit to your last two points. Mark, I thought you did a very good job of summarizing what I've called the neo-colonial, neo-feudal model. which is when the system is run out of developing world countries that it can, you know, exploit on the colonial model, it's come home in a neo-colonial thing and it's now exploiting the home population because that's all that's left. And so if that's neo-colonial model is like neo-feudal because it uses debt, right? You're not in servitude to the nobility in the medieval fashion, but you are in servitude to the nobility in terms of you owe them money, right? And they'll take away your agency in life if you don't continue making your payments, right? So,
and the money you're using is actually debt, but over back yeah. over to you.
Right, right. So that, but I think that that's a very interesting structure because that you described, because I think it's true, and I think it's kind of cannibalizing. You know, the system is now cannibalizing itself. It's run out of other nations that it can sort of strip mine and exploit, except through the currency. And I just want to add a footnote. The game that's being played now globally is, how do you hitch a ride to the global benefits of the dollar, US dollar reserve currency? Well, you peg to it. So the Chinese have successfully attached their cart to the dollar for the last, you know, 30 years by pegging the RMB to the dollar. And so they've been able to print money themselves because they're like saying, wow, look at us, we're pegged to the US dollar. So people are accepting these yuan RMB that's just as fiat as anything printed by the Federal Reserve. So, and then what happens is you get called on that at some point. Like the Thais, the Thai Central Bank, Thailand, they had pegged to the dollar too. And then eventually the market called them on it. And then it was triggered a crisis and a devaluation because it was like, well, you guys just chose a peg out of thin air. You know, that's not good enough. And so that's the vulnerability of any reserve currency and everybody pegging to it, just as a side topic. But I want to talk real quickly to Jesse's point, which is, you know, that where is the leverage point that threatens the status quo, you know, the current arrangement? And, you know, I think your point is extremely valuable, that the normal sort of political churn isn't really threatening. And we're seeing that even when they burn down huge chunks of the inner city, it's all like, oh, everybody is saying, oh yeah, that's wonderful, we're gonna reopen Walmart, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it didn't really threaten them because they're making their money through financialization and globalization, not through actual sales. And so, and then to go back to an anecdotal thing, what did threaten the establishment in the US was draft resistance in the Vietnam War. That panicked the central power. And anecdotally, I've read that the FBI abandoned all of its efforts to combat organized crime and devoted virtually every waking minute to tracking down draft dodgers. And I have personal experience of this because I was with a friend who was arrested by the FBI who showed up in force. And it was all like, wait a minute, you know, we're just like a couple of kids in Honolulu. I mean, but no, the FBI, that was the task of that era.
What did you do during that era, Charles?
Well, I was at the tail end of it. And so I applied for conscientious objector status, and I did get that. But of course, that didn't mean that you weren't going to serve in some capacity. I did not burn my draft card, but since I was with my friend, then I was, you know, interrogated by the FBI, which it's not a fun thing when you're 19 years old.
Yeah.
And they were tracking, what they wanted to get out of me was who else I knew who was a draft resister, because they wanted to nail them.
We need names.
Yeah, we need names. Yeah, it's so I think Jesse's point is really interesting, because we should be asking, well, where is the leverage point on the status quo? What would they be threatened by? And I would say it's by no longer borrowing money and no longer spending money. I think that's what they'd be terrified of.
Yeah, reducing
debt. Which makes sense given what they're saying in the media. So sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, just, you know, what I always tell people, like, just the sort of short bullet point thing is, you know, own gold, have some crypto, reduce debt, stop watching television, read more books, and start your own business, right? That's how you radicalize yourself. And if everyone did that, it would, well, not everyone, but if enough people do it, then you start to get that decentralized kind of traction, momentum going. I don't want to make too esoteric a reference. Charles, were the kids in the hall a thing in the U.S.? I mean, I know Jesse knows them. They were like a comedy troupe here in Canada. Have you ever heard of them?
They were on NBC for a bit.
They were what?
They were on NBC for a bit.
But just the whole conversation about financialization reminds me of one of their skits where the guy's in the laundromat doing laundry and Dave Foley is sitting, suddenly kind of springs out, hey, I want to talk to you for a minute. I want to like talk to you about monetizing your underwear. And the guy's like, what? You want my underwear? He's like, no. We don't want your underwear. We make money over the idea of monetizing your underwear. And they go back and forth in these circular abstractions for a while, and that was it. He met this guy in a laundromat whose, you know, financial model was monetizing the idea of your underwear. And that's kind of where we are today. Like when Hertz, who's bankrupt, was going to issue $1 billion of stock. Like it's instantly worthless equity that all the kids on Robinhood were going to buy. And I, you know, the SEC finally flew a penalty flag on that one and said, no, you cannot issue new stock when you're bankrupt, right? But that's, you know, that's financialization writ large.
I mean, I'm curious, Mark, to hear you elaborate more about the kids on Robinhood, because as someone who is not in that world, I'm seeing that come up more, because I'm reading interesting, I guess anecdotes is the best way to describe it, that there are more people dabbling in day trading right now, in particular people who have no business doing so, but they're not working, they're at home, they're anxious about the future, like every arrogant person, think that they're smarter than everybody else, and are therefore taking what little money they have to double down, which is ironic because we're talking about that it's the opposite of that. That would be a threat to the system.
It's not just...
This is exactly what the system is trying to induce people into doing through its own narratives of there's nothing to fear here, but hey, this is a real opportunity to make money.
Well, you just set me off in a million different directions. Yes, the system induces you out further out the risk curve because they've kept interest rates low for over 10 years and they'll probably go negative. So it's like they're compelling you out the risk curve. The Robin Hood kids, I mean, I've heard that one of the catalysts behind all this is because major league sports are done, like they're over right now.
Yeah,
so the whole sports...
They need something to gamble on.
Exactly. And they're taking their stimulus checks and their paycheck protection checks and putting it into Robinhood because everything goes up. I mean, that's the thing. So the evangelist of this is a guy named Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports.
What's the significance of Robinhood?
So Robinhood is a trading platform, so there's no trading commissions, okay?
But it's the trading platform that basically spies on people's intent.
Yeah, that's how they do it.
That jump ahead of the market, right?
So it's no trading commissions, so you trade for free because otherwise your trading costs would add up. But they sell the order flow to the high frequency traders, so then the HFT places can front run your order flow and just salami shave, you know, fractions of pennies.
If I understand your analogy correctly, these are people who usually gamble on sports. So these are the biggest suckers around. Who are showing up at the most crooked casino that guarantees the house is going to win, and yet this is where they're going to play.
Pretty much, yeah. And I've heard, and I don't know if I heard this before I heard of Robin Hood, so I don't know if it's the same thing, but I've heard, like, you remember those old Hot or Not apps that people would, like, they'd put a picture on and you'd kind of go yes or no and swipe left or swipe right. Well, they do that for stocks now. So it kind of like stick Tesla, and, yeah, I'll buy that, and I'll, no, not that. So you're just kind of like swiping, you know, yeah, I'll take a, you know, and so it's all this kind of like gamified dopamine hit. And they're not wrong, because the Fed's going to just do whatever it takes to make sure everything keeps going up. The stock market comes off 5%, and there's practically a federal inquest into it. Well, why did this happen? And so, you know, I've listened to some pretty enlightened investors who are just throwing their hands up in the air. They're like, they're not wrong. Why wouldn't you do this? This is actually now the work of a rational actor. And in fact,
I think you're getting carried away. I think that, yes, the fools are right to not think they're fools, but they're still fools. And they're still going to get burned. And the volatility of the market means that the high-frequency traders are the ones who are going to win. And the people making bets are just never going to be fast enough to actually see those bets succeed in the long term. Or am I wrong in thinking that?
I mean, yes. That is the cognitive dissonance that's going on right now. It's like, what is happening should absolutely not be happening. But it's happening, and there's every indication, everything is reliant upon this continuing to happen. Because if this game is over, the entire game is over. So there is so much will to keep this bubble inflating that these people being right for the wrong reason doesn't matter. It has to keep going. So there's this meme going around where it's like a three-panel thing, and it's like, you know, IQ below 100, stocks are going up, buy the stocks, right? And then IQ between 100 and 130 is like, this doesn't seem right, nothing's going, you know, why would you do this? And then IQ above 130, stocks are going up, so buy the stocks. Because even the super sophisticated, you know, next level investor is looking at this, realizing that even the second and third order of this is that it still has to go up. It's really, and so the only salvation I've found out of all of this is Bill Fleckenstein's observation that he said in more than one podcast, that he says, if you really are disgusted with the dynamic in the financial markets, the only viable way to express a short thesis against it, short of like shorting the central banks of every country on the planet, is to go long gold. That's it. Because everything they do to keep the bubble going is wind at gold and, you know, precious metals back. Because that's where the smart money understands that it can only really be a one-way bet in that direction for this to continue. And the alternative is, I mean, kind of goes back to maximum pessimism and irrational exuberance coexisting at the same time. And after I sent that email this morning, I wrote Schrodinger's cat underneath the two of them on my notepad, right? It's that quantum state that both states are existing simultaneously until an external observer to the system collapses the wave function and it assumes one state or the other. And, you know, that I think that external observation is coming at us like a freight train.
Yeah, that's a fascinating analogy, Shel, because I was going to bring up, by way of anecdote, that the 1999-2000 tech bubble, where, and, you know, I don't know where you guys were. Jesse, you probably weren't trading stocks. I was. A lot of people were, just like now. And it was one of those things, you just buy a tech stock, and if you were lucky, it went up 40% in a week, and if you were unlucky, it went up 40% in a month. And I knew we had some friends, one of whom worked at Oracle down in the peninsula, and she said that in the lunchroom, people were trading stocks just to make lunch money. Like if you could clear 10 bucks, you did good. And this was when the commissions were $10. So you'd have to make 20 bucks on that trade to net 10. So it's just this kind of frivolous thing, that which I think the psychology is pretty appealing, you know, dopamine, et cetera. And the Robin Hood crew is in that. But, you know, I want to raise a point here. One of my pet theories, and just imagine me putting on my tinfoil hat here. But I'm really skeptical of the idea that the market is going to continue to rise through the U.S. election for the reason that the deep state has been trying to draw a target on Donald Trump's back for 4 years, right? Everything they've shot has failed. You know, every arrow missed him. And so now they've got one card left, which is the stock market, which is his, you know, the feather in his cap, the one that he's the proudest of. And he's basically hitched his cart to the stock market. You know, live or die, stock market goes up, I'm a fantastic leader. So what would the deep state need to do to crash the market? Well, they need to get to Jerome Powell and the rest of the Fed governors and just tell them, hey, you're going to have to take one here for the team. No more money printing. You make whatever excuse you got to do, but you are not going to live to see the day where you're going to allow the market to skyrocket into September and October. You're going to have an accident. Did we make it clear enough? And so we already see the Fed hasn't jacked up its balance sheet in 3 weeks. And so I just think, you know, the Fed, you know, Federal Reserve likes to claim it's not political, it's apolitical, although it stands above politics, et cetera, but we know that's just not the way government works, right? So, and institutions work. So isn't there gonna be tremendous pressure on the Federal Reserve to empty the punch bowl? Because if they let the stock market continue soaring through September, October, they're basically handing Trump the election. And I don't think the deep state's gonna be too happy with that idea.
I also just don't, given the pandemic, I don't see the stock market going up in that period anyway. I mean, no matter how foolish some of these traders are, at some point, I think the reality of this pandemic is not only depict an economy that is completely devastated, but a psychology, a collective psychology, that I think will, you know, override this irrational exuberance. And that's where, you know, I understand that in between the first wave and the second wave, there was room for all sorts of optimism, all sorts of belief that this was small and this would be, you know, overcome. I still see people now believing in a vaccine and thinking that a vaccine is going to provide an effective way out of this crisis. And I'm just bearish when it comes to the way in which this pandemic is going to play out. And I think that is going to overcome the ludicrous nature of capital markets presently and will very much change the psychology of society as a whole. I think a parallel discussion to this is whether a lockdown will ever again be viable. And I'm not so sure it will. I kind of feel that the first lockdown was so mismanaged and psychologically devastating so many people that lockdowns as a response are going to have decreasing effect and decreasing compliance. And I think the nature in which this pandemic is going to wreak havoc, not just in North America, what it's doing in Brazil right now is absolutely insane. You know, what it's doing in Russia is insane. What it's doing in South Africa is insane. Right, when you start looking at how this is going to devastate the globalized economy, I don't think there's any way that, you know, whether the elite or whether those who just want to see stocks go up are going to be able to put this Humpty Dumpty back together. I think we are quickly and rapidly shifting into the battle for new narratives, which is both going to be how to respond to all this, but get into the who's responsible and how did we get here, and you know, why did this house of cards collapse so easily and quickly. But I think, given that one of the recurring themes of today's episode is the emotional and psychological impact of our current situation, I think that's going to be the overriding effect. I'm not convinced it's going to get rid of Trump. I think there's a lot of scenarios in which he remains in power. And I think it is perfectly possible for the stock market to crash, for the economy to be visibly destroyed and for him to still be the president of the United States, or whatever you'd call the chief executive of whatever remains. And I think that that is a whole other dynamic to this dystopia that, that we should be cognizant of. I did an event earlier this week for a Canadian audience, Canadian government audience, and you know, it was a fairly optimistic tone, and everyone was like, yeah, we got this, we got it going on. And all I had to do was sort of point out raging dystopia happening south of us. And everyone sort of acknowledged, okay, yeah, you're right. We can pretend everything's okay, but you know, forest fires don't discriminate.
We need to build a wall.
But a wall of what, you know? That's where I think we underestimate the psychological impact of what we're witnessing, which I think is going to tank global markets in all regards.
I think that psychological impact that's what's been weighing on me this week and leading into last week. I do tend to, I think you may have something there that the stock market could crack and the economy, well, it has cracked, and you could still see Trump win the election, because I just see the, I think when people look at what the George Floyd protests have turned into or are turning into, that would scare them, and they're kind of looking at this saying this is like anarchy in the streets, and it's I think it's like we'll take stability over anarchy any day of the week. We don't care if it's this, you know, inarticulate bumbling president over here, we'll just go with what we know. I think that can be a big factor in November. But again, I mean, I don't want to prognosticate on U.S. politics too much. It's just, I can't even picture there being an election right now.
I think it's an assumption that there's an election, and that's why I use the word dystopia.
I think that could be the next, or one of the next sort of beats in this, you know, collapse into a dark age story of like an election gone badly in the global superpower just kind of puts us into yet another, you know, pivotal marker in history. There was everything that happened before 9/11, then everything happened after 9/11, then it was everything before the financial crisis and everything after this financial crisis, and then it'll be everything before coronavirus as distinct from everything after coronavirus, and then the next beat in that sequence of Rubicons could be everything before the US 2020 election and everything after. And if you notice, those beats are coming closer together. And
yeah,
I
think they're going to call 2020.
You think they're going to what?
I think
you broke
it's
up a bit.
Coronavirus. I don't think it's going to be the election. I think this year is all going to be grouped into one big turd ball and will be regarded as such.
I think if they call a force majeure on the election in November, it will break the country apart. It will just be like, there will not be.
I agree. I'm just saying they're going to call it 2020.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Or maybe they'll call it
zero. Yeah. I get what you mean. But the point remains that it's that sort of next seminal moment, I think, that really just breaks it wide open into Brave New World. You know,
well, let's ask the American
beyond Thunderdome.
Well, I was just going to talk about how there's a couple of big U.S. national parks that share park borders with Canada. So you go up there into Glacier National Park, and then you just start hiking, and oh gosh, I got lost. And
can
I catch a bus to Ottawa Valley from here?
Look, it's funny you say that, but there are actually a huge issue right now with Americans because our border's closed, but the government is allowing Americans in who say they're going to Alaska. So they're not denying Americans who are claiming that they are taking, you know, roads to get to America. But it turns out that they're taking detours to go to places like Banff and Jasper and other nice locations, at which point Canadians are vandalizing their cars because they don't want the virus. They don't want, you know, Americans in the country. So you're right that our border's porous, but it's dangerous how people are reacting to Americans who have used that porous border to do some sightseeing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because that's an issue that's also present in Hawaii, that there's some backlash that citizen groups are now tracking down tourists who are violating the 14-day quarantine. And they're being labeled snitches, but from the point of view of the residents here, it's all like, good. You know, if people are going to completely ignore our rules, then they should be arrested and sent back to wherever they came from. End of story. Goodbye. And so, it's a rational response. Why would you just say, oh, yeah, you can break our rules and spread the virus? And there's just too many people in America. That's another issue. I mean, what do you do with 330 million people? It's a lot. And so people are already...
There is a lot of wilderness, though.
Yeah, a lot of wilderness. But, you know, there's this questions in a lot of people's minds here about whether there's going to be an exodus out of these urban jungles to, you know, rural towns and so on. And it's like, well, there's a lot of land, but I don't know if there's enough houses if like 20 million people decide to exit these rotting metropolises.
I think there will be a massive deurbanization, like a secular shift. I'm not talking like it happens by the end of the year. I'm talking like the next 20 years, I think we'll see this. And it goes back to, I mentioned them in one of our podcasts, and I forget his name now, but the guy who sent me his book like 15 years ago, saying he called it Penturbia, and there's going to be this big financial crisis and it will cause this deurbanization. And I ordered his other book, which actually just came a couple days ago, so I'm gonna check that out. And but I really, you know, people are gonna follow Jesse. They're gonna go, you know, to the Ottawa Valley. They're gonna go to Perth County, or, you know, the American equivalents. It makes too much sense not to do it.
That's a pretty good ending point. I'll just start tracing out, you know, my hiking route in Glacier to the nearest bus stop. and you know, Jesse, it sounds like you have plenty of land, and I'll be happy to rehab a chicken coop or something. You know, I've lived in, like, you know, 10 by 12 foot plywood shacks I made, and they're really quite comfortable, I have to say.
You haven't experienced the Ottawa Valley winter.
Yes.
We'll need insulation for sure.
See, winters in Canada is what separates the interlopers from the survivors, right? Like, yeah, that's what will keep the riffraff out.
I think the riffraff are already here. We are the riffraff.
Yeah. Okay, guys, you want to leave it there for this week? So look for us on Stitcher, Spotify, our YouTube channel. Like us, comment, tell all your friends. And that was Access of Easy Salon number 10. We'll see you in a week.